You're listening to the Movie Rob Minute Podcast. Thanks for tuning in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 89 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1980 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Aaron Newirth of Out Now with Aaron and Abe. Welcome back, Aaron.
Happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you. Just make sure you hunt down that little... All right, so exactly. Is that a Usual Suspects? No, I'm just kidding. Finster. So minute 89 begins with Hans finishing his instructions to Theo and ends with Hasseldorf beginning to answer. So yesterday we finished things off with Hans talking to Theo and says, so be of good cheer and call me. And the answer is when you hit the last lock. But as we know from the script, he already has hit the last lock. And then he turns to Carl and goes, Carl, hunt that little shit down and get those detonators. So his response, Carl's response is, Fritz is checking the explosives. And then Hans goes, I'll check the explosives. You get the detonators. So... how would you define the term little shit as opposed to big shit? What's little
What is it? The fly in the ointment, you know, the little distraction, that rock in your shoe. It's this thing that, you know, everything else is going perfectly fine, but there's one thing that's causing a problem, one little thing.
Right. Okay. So, according to the Urban Dictionary, it's an individual who does the exact opposite of what you tell them. They can be extremely annoying and sometimes take it too far. They crave attention and will do anything to get it. They're usually very childish, but deep down, they are sensitive creatures. Now, I have no idea how that actually, you know, connects to this. It's like, else is, it could be a precocious child who, you know, who can anticipate their parents' actions. And they take preventative measures.
Okay.
So, yeah. I don't really know how that really fits in there. But, you know, this is one of the few times that we actually hear Hans swear. He doesn't really swear throughout the movie.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's quite rare. So, apparently, you know, John has gotten on his nerves enough that he's going to start swearing here.
Well, now he has a key part of his thing, right? He has his detonators, which that's something he needs. Like, it's one thing to just have a guy who's running around that he can close off somewhere, but it's another thing to have him affecting the plan that he has.
But he's known about this for a while. This isn't, you know, he didn't just find out that the explosives are with John.
Yeah, but now it's coming closer to the time where he's going to actually need them, so it's, you know.
Sorry, the detonators are with him, yeah. Not the explosives.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct, but even if you need them, you want to have them on you. You know, you would think, see, beforehand, he kept talking about the fact that, okay, you know, just leave him boxed in, and we'll eventually deal with him. But if it's something that's so essential to his plan, you would think that he would want to do all he can to, you know, to get it sooner.
It's overconfidence. Like, he thinks he can handle it, and it's not getting handled as quick as he wants it to.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
Ego.
Get a shot once again, and we hear Powell. Oh, we hear John say to Powell, "Hey, Powell, you out there? I'm here, John. I'm here. You gotta believe me. There was nothing I could do. Well, it's gonna be both our asses if you're wrong. I hear you. Did you catch that bull? Hans was running. Doesn't make sense, man. Don't ask me, man. I'm just a desk jockey who was on my way home when you rang. The way you drove that car, I figured you for the street, Al. In my youth. So, first of all, I love this conversation between the two of them.
Sure.
It adds a lot more to the development of these two characters and their relationship. which is so important to the movie.
Yeah,
you know, because it gives hope to both of them.
It does. It makes it
more, by the fact they have this type of connection.
It grounds it. It makes it more human. Gives characters more dimension.
Yeah,
because you have something to play off of, as opposed to stop speaking only about the plot. You have characters talking about things that are related to them, as you know, people, you know, personality wise.
Well, he's talking about the plot here. He's talking about, you know, Ellis.
Yeah, but it, you know what I'm saying. In terms of like
everything leads to Ellis.
How they're how they're relating to each other. You know, it's not. There's no momentum in the plot there. That's just talking, essentially.
Right. Correct. But it works.
Yeah. It's organic. It's organic to the situation while adding to what these actors are bringing to the roles.
And you know, it's good. You know, John is all on his own. So for us to hear him talking to someone else and making a connection and stuff like that, you know, if it would have been anyone else besides Al, it wouldn't have worked. Mm-hmm. You know, if it was Robinson who was always on the phone, you know, maybe John would have given up already and said, Hans, come and take me. I can't handle this guy anymore. Again, it goes back to the whole point where this is a party line. Everyone can hear this conversation. You know, the two of them have to somehow find a way to be able to have these private conversations.
I wouldn't necessarily want that to be private, though. If I, you know, I'd want the police to be aware that this guy is making stuff up. Like, he does not care about these, you know, political these groups. Like, I don't think John's worried about someone overhearing the fact that he does not buy into what Hans is selling whatsoever. I think he wants them to know that you guys need to be smarter about this. This guy's not asking for this.
Right.
Like, that's not something he needs to be vague about compared to, like, his identity.
Right, but again, it's fun to...
Yeah, it's fun to think about the idea that there's the cops, like, hanging out, listening to all this going on, that's for sure.
Exactly, because there's nothing else for them to be doing at the time. What else, you know? Yeah, no, so it works the way that they do that. And, you know, as I said, it's working to help establish an even firmer connection between the two of them. Then, basically, you know, when John says, you got to believe me, there was nothing I could do, do you think he's doubting himself? Because he doesn't sound as confident as you would think he should be saying those lines.
I think telling Al is more him telling himself, because he hasn't spoken outwardly about this. But I think it's a matter of trying to not absolve himself, but certainly like just make sure he's saying these things out loud to understand, like, they're, you know, working it out in his head as far as getting over this to go, you know, move forward. It's like, there's nothing I could do. Like, what could, like, he's saying that out, like, he's saying it to Al, but I think he's also telling it to himself.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, in your opinion, we discussed this a little bit over the last few days, but do you think he handled the Ellis situation correctly?
Yes.
Do you think he could have done it differently?
You know, it's... Not in terms of what his goal was for that scene. Like, could he phrase things differently? Sure, but I don't think. I mean, I think he took it seriously all the way through. Like, it's, you know, he wasn't being the wisecracking John McClane in that sequence. He was telling Ellis very specifically that and telling Hans that he knows who this guy. He knows the kind of person this is. He knows he's not playing around. He knows there's no room for this kind of arrogance on Ellis's part to think that he can get through this. You need to stop this game, and you need to back down, because it's going to get you killed. I can't give in, or else everybody right. gets killed, or, you know, they win, which I can't let happen. Like, I don't think there's a version of this that goes better for anybody involved.
Okay, that makes sense. You know, again, part of the whole idea here is that Ellis had to die.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, plot-wise,
that's an essential part.
Yeah,
it's an essential part of the plot. It, you know, to help, you know, to show that even if someone is going to try to save the situation, it isn't necessarily going to work.
I would say, like, know, then, if it was the John McClane who was making, you know, one-liners and wisecracks to Hans separate from this conversation, then obviously he would need to feel remorse, and we'd like him less as a character because he didn't treat this with, you know, any kind of sincerity. But because he drops all the shtick and does exactly what he can in the most dramatic ways you can, you know, in the most serious way, you buy into that. You get that it's not just playing around between two guys. even though there's lives at stake, it's someone's realistically going to die if I don't try to handle this the best I can. He fails at that, but it's not like he didn't do his best to try to prevent that from happening.
Right. Because again, he's not a negotiator. He just was, he's just trying to think quick on his feet of how to, deal with the situation. Okay, you have this guy who's claiming that he's my friend. He's not. They're going to kill us anyway. So maybe if he's not my friend, they won't kill him.
Yeah, I mean, even then, if Ellis is some kind of silver-tongued magic negotiator, there's no version of that where Ellis walks out alive. He needs to increase those stakes regardless.
Right. No, but this way, at least John is able to distance himself from it.
Yeah. That's what I've been saying. Yeah, Ellis's death is not John's fault. It's just unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, depends on for who. It helps Holly. Holly moved up two rungs. Yeah. maybe there's a world where Holly is behind all of this because she wanted to become the CEO.
I know you're joking, but there's easier means on her part. She wouldn't need to go through all this stuff. Her ultimate plan was just, I'll just hire some terrorists.
I'll just hire some terrorists. I mean, they said that
instead of dissolving my marriage and changing my name, just hire some terrorists.
No, but this way she can become the CEO because she can get rid of Takagi, she can get rid of Ellis. She talks about that she wants Ellis's private bathroom, they currently were in when she said it, but that's a separate issue.
Sure, but that's just a bad movie that you're describing at that point. It's it was me the whole time. Okay, whatever.
Oh, it would have been an interesting twist.
I mean, that's like Air Force One,
where Hans grabs her at the end and says, instead of saying I moved up to kidnapping, you could just say, you got me into this.
Or it is White House Down to some degree also. It's other Die Hard knockoffs as far as, there's some mole inside the whole time that was actually behind everything. We've seen it.
Right. Well, there has to be some sort of mole here. They never really go into detail about it.
It's a shift in that's the shift in the atmosphere that we the time and space we live in. The '80s is the Reagan '80s, so this is more about having a non Arnold guy, a non Stallone guy, a regular guy being involved in with activities involving Euro trash essentially as the villain. Things shift away in the '90s and the 2000s when you have more. I mean, the '90s, it's more like the president's the good guy because there's certain attitudes that reflect that as far as the kind of, rock star action hero that your president's supposed to be. Then you get to the 2000s and you get to 24, post 9/11 Bush era, where things become more shady. And there's more moles. There's more people behind the scenes that are pulling the strings. And things change.
Right. But I'm looking at it from the perspective that think about the plot here. Okay. How does Hans know that they have all these bearer bonds? Somebody had to tell him. This isn't something that's listed, among the assets of the company.
I mean, I hear what you're saying. I would say that's nowadays that would be a part of the plot. That would be very much a part of the screenplay where you'd have someone that's secretly on the inside. That's very much a more modern element. Back in those, something like Heat or various bank robbery movies, it's not about having some guy that works at the bank that's on the inside. It's just, no, the criminal underground just found out that, this is the day where there's going to be $1 billion being transferred in a cargo ship or whatever. It's just stuff that gets found without it being a crucial plot element as far as a disgruntled employee or whatever.
Right. Okay. No. I'm glad that you're explaining the way that things have moved over the decades. I actually find that very fascinating.
It is.
Obviously, I've seen movies.
I've seen
how that works, but I never thought about it from that perspective.
Yeah, it's generally just a reflection of the times, right? Where you have 70 paranoia thrillers in the 70s, right? You have more of this kind of machismo element in the 80s that lasts just long enough to be parodied by the end of the 80s to some degree, whether it's an outright comedy or just something that's commenting on it. The 90s gets a little more, it gets away from certain things, it brings in other elements, and like I said, the government seems, it's a mix of things. It's interesting to watch something like Independence Day, Air Force One, where the hero is the president, then you get to the end of the 90s, things shift a bit, then the 2000s is just, it's conspiracies everywhere, always conspiracies. that's the name of the game.
No, but there's something I never thought about, the fact that that it's a reflection of the time by the whole thing. Because again, there are plot holes in this movie revolving around the information. That's what it comes down to. But, I mean, what you're saying is very plausible. The fact that, okay, somehow the information got the Hans that they have the $600 billion worth of bearer bonds, you know, just sitting there in the vault.
I mean, it's less about, it's not a plot hole so much as it's an element that goes unexplained. Like, it's, you know, it's not something that's breaking the story. It's just, if you want a 4-hour movie, then we can explain all these things, but that's boring.
Right. That's true. No, this movie has a good runtime. You know, I don't think there are very many lulls in the story.
Oh, no. This movie's a rocket. That's where there's never, yeah.
Yeah.
Even the slowest point is when he's pulling glass out of his feet and telling the story. That's the slowest part of the movie, and like that's not unexciting. That's great stuff to listen to.
Yeah.
Which comes down to characters once again. If they're boring characters, you don't want to care anything about them.
That's the character development there.
Like you could say the same.
That wouldn't have worked without the type of conversations that they're having here.
Yeah. Or even like the basic
setup. You know, if he would have just screamed back then, you know, then, and he's talking about pulling, glass out of his feet, and he hadn't had these conversations with Al before, it would have, you know, it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah. Same with the early setup when you have just McClane walking around the, you know, getting to the building and everything. It's because Willis is a fountain of charisma, and you have Ellis, you know, you have Hal Bachman, you have Bonnie Bedelia, you have Takagi. They are interesting characters to pay attention to. You don't just walk into that room and be like, "Oh, this is boring." It's like, no, I want to hear about this stuff. I want to get this dynamic down.
Right. It's true. And then the shot changes, and we're back in the TV studio, and we get our news anchor Gail Wallins. Okay, she starts off mid-sentence and says, "And author of Hostage Terrorist, Terrorist Hostage, a Study in Duality."
It's so funny. That's such a silly book title. They made a cover and everything. That's really funny.
Yeah. I wonder if it's like based on something. You know, if they tried to, you know, if someone had seen some sort of, psychology.
That's very much, like, homaging this idea of, you know, these like how do you relate to the killer type books and things like that were, you know, coming around.
Yeah. And then she continues and goes, "Dr. Hasseldorf.
Yeah.
What can we expect in the next few hours?"
Like, this is all, that's pure parody. Everything going on in the TV studios is just parody, like, of like how you respond to this scenario.
Yeah. But again, what's interesting here is that nowadays, when something is happening, you constantly have talking heads on every single channel doing exactly what they're doing here, trying to explain the situation. You know, even if you think back to, you know, 9/11, okay, I remember being glued to the TV that day, you know, and people are talking about basically nothing because they don't understand what they're talking about, but they're still talking. And they're trying to explain what we're possibly seeing, you know, and it's, you know, this is a movie that came out 34 years ago, and they knew at the time that you could still do that, or that you could already do that. You know, I don't think it was as prevalent back then. I mean, CNN hadn't, I don't think CNN had even launched in 88, or it might have just been around the time that it was launching. You know, where you have constant 24-hour news, where you could bring in talking heads to discuss different situations and stuff like that. Like I said, I mean, nowadays it's commonplace, but then it wasn't as commonplace. And it's fun to look at this and say, wow, they knew what they were talking about by bringing someone in to just, you know, talk out of his ass. Basically, that's what he's doing here. Because he has no clue.
Yeah.
As we'll see tomorrow when we get into that. You know, today we just get two words from him. Well, Gel. And then he gets cut off. You know, he doesn't really have much to say at that point. But what's, you know, basically they're just hypothesizing here. Everything, even with Thornburg possibly listening in on some of the conversations, you know, I wonder, you know, it makes you wonder what he has passed on to them. You know, has he passed on to them the demands? Which I'm assuming he has heard, or he hasn't left yet to go find John.
I mean, I would argue no, just because he wants all that he can to himself. I mean, he's probably passed on as much as he feels he needs to pass on, but nothing juicy.
Right, okay. That makes sense. So do you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
My notes. No, I just really like the title, Hostage Terrorist, Terrorist Hostage. That's just so stupid.
That'll be the title of your next book.
Mm-hmm.
No, I love the fact that it's a study in duality.
Yeah.
You know,
to really bring it home.
Which basically says that hostages and terrorists are the same. They're one and the same. So the script has just a few minor discrepancies here. First of all, instead of Powell saying "I'm here, John," he says "I'm here, cowboy." Mm-hmm. But I think it's better the John point because it strengthens the connection between the two of them. And John's response was great because in the movie, he says, "Did you catch that bullshit Hans was running?" And here he goes, "Speaking of cows, did you ever hear so much bullshit in your life? 2 hours? That doesn't even make any sense."
So they were.
So I guess because they changed the cowboy.
Yeah, they're trying to have some fun with wordplay, and Willis and Jill Johnson were just like, "Yeah, let's do it our own way."
I don't think so. Yeah, let's just make this
because it's deeper with drama. Like it's a more dramatic scene. It's like you can't just make everything lighthearted, or else you're not gonna take it seriously.
Correct. And then just the direction that they have here for the studio is great. It says. You know, TV studio night, Gail and Harvey have company, a man from the Senator Paul Simon School of Grooming. You know Senator Paul Simon was, don't you? He was the guy with the bow ties?
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, it's very descriptive. That works from that perspective. All right, so every Thursday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track, Holiday Edition, where my guests will give a little story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure of something that happened to them over the course of their lives that's somehow related to the holidays. So, Aaron, you got another story for us?
Yeah, so 2008, I'm in Israel during the end of December, and that year Hanukkah was much later. It began... I believe like around Christmas, but like it lasted to either the end of the year. It wouldn't have gone to New Year. So it was happening like during the end of December, essentially. Cause I was there during Christmas and during New Year's, but like, I assume Hanukkah probably had ended by New Year's. So regardless, the thing that
it started on December 21st, okay. 2008 and ended on December 29th.
There you go. So, being in Israel during Hanukkah, I delighted myself in having a jelly donut, at least one, every single day. It was the best.
Only one?
No, at least one. I had many jelly donuts. I have a picture of me with a jelly donut in my mouth. I have so many memories of great jelly donuts from different places, whether it was random markets, hotel, you know, morning breakfast, pastries. Any chance I could get, I was like, I'm going to get myself a jelly donut. I'm very much delighted in having jelly donuts every single day, fresh in Israel. It was great.
Yeah, that is one of the. Yeah, it's one of the things that always, I mean, when I grew up in America, so potato pancakes was what we had, latkes. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have donuts, but here in Israel,
donuts. Apparently.
It's like, donuts.
Yeah.
Just donuts, donuts, donuts.
Like I had latkes, but I cannot remember them compared to the amount of jelly donuts I had.
Right, okay, no, that makes sense. It's, in Israel. It's very...
To be clear, in Israel, I can't remember the latkes.
No, but in Israel, you don't find latkes.
I know, it's I'm saying, it's like, I know, like, they probably had, you know, just part of a buffet or something like that, but yes, it wasn't, like, the specialty of the area, I'm very aware. So,
right,
like, exactly. I can't specifically recall having them, even if I did, but I very much recall the donuts.
Yeah, because you get them everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just unbelievable the different types of jelly donuts that they have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've over the last few years, they've gotten even more extravagant with the different things that they put on them and stuff like that. You know, so you should come back and get some more jelly donuts, you know, come Hanukkah.
Yeah.
You know, then we can meet up.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
All right, great. So you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, you can find more of my work at thecodeofzeke.com. That's my personal blog where everything I do ends up. I co-host a podcast out now there today with my friend Abe. We talk about weekly movie releases. I write for Why So Blue for Blu-ray and Criterion reviews. I write for We Live Entertainment for movie reviews. And I'm on Twitter at AaronsPS4.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. And you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, Aaron, you want to come back tomorrow and finish off the week and find out what Hasseldorf has to say? Maybe Harvey will interject.
Yes, let's do it.
All right, sounds good. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!